Late into one miserable autumn night recently, still several steps ahead of the sleep that refused to overtake me, and with no disturbance to my long-tolerant other half by my side, I switched on the radio, inserted my earpiece, and sought mental emollience via the soothingly erudite vibes of the BBC World Service. I listened languidly as the top of the hour news bulletin followed the Greenwich pips, before being shaken from my reverie by a remarkable piece of reportage from the good old US of A. Where else? Declaring the Ohio State House of Representatives has passed legislation that exams mustn't be marked down for non-scientific views, provided the reasoning is within principles of expressed religion. What? It's true. I looked it up on the BBC website later at a more sensible hour. Ohio House Bill 164, known as the Ohio Students' Religious Liberties Act, includes reasonable clauses such as preventing schools from denying students access to facilities because of their religion. However, controversy is focused on a section that reads, "Assignment grades and scores shall be calculated using ordinary academic standards of substance and relevance, including any legitimate pedagogical concerns, and shall not penalise or reward a student based on the religious content of their work." In other words, as was later explained helpfully by local TV station WKRC, provided students offer a reasoned argument, they will not be castigated for suggesting the Earth is only 6,000 years old. Or, indeed, flat. Arguably, if the bill passes the Senate and is signed by the governor, all students will need to do is find a religion that endorses every error and claims it as their own. And, at least until the law is tested in court, some teachers may be reluctant to criticise unscientific answers in the face of a potential lawsuit arguing they have breached the student's religious liberty. The Ohio Senate has an even more overwhelming Republican majority than the House, so at the time of comprising this, the Act's chances of passage are high. Whilst I confess to being taken aback by the prospect of a flat earth becoming enshrined in law, the premise was not new to me, and falling on my background as an inland waterways devotee, I hearkened to the time around 20 years ago when I undertook a modest study for a magazine article in which my opening gambit contained the lines, "The waterways are not immune to the attentions of those who march to the beat of a different drum, and have attracted their share of Fruit Loops and basket cases over the years, none more so than loyalists of the flat earth theory." In light of these developments that now prevent discouragement of, one could even say actively promote such beliefs, 2 decades after my original piece, I may be obliged by default to revisit my taxonomy of Fruit Loops and basket cases. So let's take another look. One might have thought that the evidence of satellite photographs would have destroyed any vestige of resistance from the Flat Earth fraternity. Not so. Such evidence is considered a monumental conspiracy, as propounded by the likes of the 1950s film Destination Moon, or latterly Capricorn 1, both of which reflect scepticism towards the veracity of space exploration. Capricorn 1, which tells the tale of a government hoax created to deceive the public on a supposed Mars landing, first appeared on screen in 1978 as a barely imaginable futuristic plot. Gosh, the mind boggles what theories will bubble to the top as contemporary plans to actually put humans on Mars approach reality. Meanwhile, back on our flat Earth, the argument is as old as recorded history itself, and was equated directly with the literal word of the Bible. In the 6th century, the Greek monk Cosmas wrote his Christian Topography, in which he refuted the false and heathen notion that the Earth is a sphere. There's just a couple of religious connections as enshrined in Ohio House Bill 164. History has also been enlivened with pronouncements from such luminaries as Copernicus, Galileo and Newton, but it was the Victorians who procured some of the most contentious evidence in support of both camps, and they chose as their battleground a section of the old Bedford Level which lies just on the edge of the Middle Level Navigations. There, Now that explains my interest in this quest. The reason for their choice lay in the landscape, a tale which itself goes back thousands of years. Following the end of the last ice age, rising sea levels severed Britain from mainland Europe and flooded the area now known as the Fens. The land became separated from the sea by sandbanks, and the protection this afforded encouraged dense vegetation that was laid down as peat deposits. By the Norman Conquest, these had risen in places above the level of the sea and already housed several settlements. Flood banks were built from Roman times, and although there is further evidence of reclamation works in the Middle Ages, it was the 17th century before any comprehensive drainage scheme was attempted. Between 1630 and 1655, the Dutchman Sir Cornelius Vermuyden reclaimed much land by massive workings that included the cuts of the old and new Bedford rivers to bypass the meandering Great Ouse with storage areas and drainage channels to provide more direct routes to the outfalls. It was these routes that were eventually to be put to use in a manner that Vermuyden could never have envisaged. During the golden age of Victorian Enlightenment, many a noteworthy loon diverted their attentions to an uninterrupted length of about 6 miles between Welney and Old Bedford bridges. A 19th century realignment of a section to the southwest of Welney eventually compromised further experimentation, but I refuse to let this detract from such a ripping yarn of glorious eccentricity in its purest form. For several months during 1838, Dr. Samuel Burley Rowbotham lodged in a hut on the canal bank and conducted a series of experiments, always with the same result. Standing in the canal with his telescope at water level at one bridge, he found that, contrary to round earth theory which dictated that vessels would disappear from view over the horizon, he could invariably attain a clear view of the canal traffic at the other bridge. After many more years of research and verification, using his pseudonym Parallax, he published Zetetic Astronomy, Earth Not a Globe, from the Greek zetio, meaning to seek, which has since become the standard reference for anti-round earthers. The work unleashed a glut of opponents who descended on the old Bedford line, and the matter reached fever pitch in 1870 when sizable wagers were placed on the outcome of rival experiments. Independent referees were appointed, but when the opposing factions could not even agree on the interpretation of results, the matter degenerated into farce. The findings were placed before a court, but following an admirably non-committal adjudication by the Queen's Bench in 1876, the challenge was abandoned unresolved, amidst much acrimony on all sides. The controversy raged unabated, and the old Bedford level continued to be frequented by enthusiasts of both persuasions. In 1905, the irrepressible Lady Blount, a lady to whom I have referred elsewhere in my musings as frequenting the higher echelons of refined idiosyncrasy, led her entourage here with a view to settling the dispute once and for all. Sometimes known as Zetio, Lady Elizabeth Ann Mould Blount was a vocal advocate of flat earth theory in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and one of the creators of the Universal Zetetic Society, the precursor to the Flat Earth Society, founded after Rowbotham's death. Lady Blount was a devout Christian, and her writings utilised a mix of scriptural and experimental arguments to support her views. By means of a technique essentially similar to earlier experiments, in which a white sheet was hung just above the water's edge at one bridge and viewed from the other, her efforts were rewarded with a signed declaration from an independent witness which supported her proposal that the 6 miles of water, and therefore by inference the earth, were entirely flat. Lady Blount savoured the afterglow of celebrity for some time until fading into obscurity, but not before asserting via scientific publications and learned journals that the earth's flatness had been scientifically proven. The old Bedford level is not the only waterway to have achieved infamy at the hands of oddballs. In the 1890s, Cyrus Teed, self-styled leader of the Caritian Faith of America, confounded both planists and spherists when he proclaimed that the earth is in fact a hollow globe inhabited on its inside surface. The sun, moon, stars and planets are, he postulated, all only a short distance above the outer surface. The horizon, therefore, according to Teed, slopes upwards away from the observer, not downwards as in round Earth theory, or ad infinitum as per flat Earth theory. Teed supported this remarkable assertion by means of observations along the old Illinois drainage canal, using a device he called a rectilineator, parts of which still survive. Worldwide, the flat Earth theory is largely restricted to a few hidden tribes or third world countries, where the concept arises largely through ignorance rather than reasoned thought. However, there are pockets of genuine resistance and well-considered assertions, or just plain wacky theories depending on your perspective, to the idea of a round Earth, notably but not exclusively, in Southwest Britain and America. In 1956, Samuel Shenton founded the International Flat Earth Society. Following his death in 1971, Charles K. Johnson created the International Flat Earth Society of America and raised membership to 3,000. By 1980, this fell to about 200. Johnson died in 2001, and the Society no longer took in new members, until it was revived online in 2004 and officially restarted in 2009. I confess to being at a loss in offering a coherent explanation as to its resurgence, but there is evidence to suggest that the combination of a move towards religious fundamentalism, aided by the explosion in communications technology and social media, may be helping to rekindle planism. Just check the internet, it's full of the stuff. Corrishanity and the inverse globe theory have, for now at least, but who knows, all but disappeared. For me, as an aficionado, I simply find it fascinating to note the role played by ostensibly unpretentious inland waterways in the propounding of theories fundamental to our interpretations of the universe itself. So, what's your position, flat or round? Or even Corrishan? Either way, no longer will you be written off as a crank, particularly if you live in Ohio, where your views may even enjoy legal protection. And provided your reasoning is sound, you'll pass all of your exams. Me? Well, I'll just keep steering my boat along the cut in the hope that I don't one day just fall off the end somewhere. Steady as she goes, Skipper.